We're honoring the disappearance of our founder Acharya. I think it's worth spending a little bit of time discussing the immediate and long-term importance of understanding Prabhupada's position as founder Acharya. Rabindra Sarup Prabhu, a PhD graduate in, I believe, philosophy in a prestigious university in America, spent several years researching this term founder Acharya and where it came from, because there's an English word and there's a Sanskrit word. And how did it happen that those two English words, Sanskrit word, became used by Srila Prabhupada? For persons who write what to speak of an Acharya, language is very important. Choices of words, specific words, are very important. So he spent several years gathering together whatever information he could gather together, including The Harmonist. The Harmonist was a newspaper publication that Bhaktisiddhanta presented, which later, following Bhaktisiddhanta, Srila Prabhupada established similarly Back to Godhead magazine for the same purpose, regular publication of the message of Lord Chaitanya for the world in general. So he gathered up the entire collection of The Harmonist from its very first publication and read them all, you know, as a scholar will read things, searching out, you know, the history of how Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur conducted his mission. And it's explicit within The Harmonist how that was done. And then a very important part of Bhaktisiddhanta's mission was, as was given to him by his father, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, to reach the world with Lord Chaitanya's message. Coincidentally, the year of Prabhupada's birth, 1896, was the same year as Bhaktivinoda Thakur writing a pamphlet or a small book in English, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, His Life and Precepts, an 86-page thing, printed up copies at his expense and sent them to universities all over the world. Did you know that? 1896. And later, copies were found by ISKCON devotees in a university in Toronto and in a university in Bangkok. Literally, Bhaktivinoda Thakur had a vision. The world should know. Minimally, the scholarly people of the world should know. So he sent them to universities so that professors who might be more interested than the average person to read about Lord, who is Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, so they could know who he was and his life and his teaching. So the first half of that book was his lila, and the second half was his teachings. And his teachings were in a standard Bhaktivinoda Thakur format, that is the Dasamula Tattva, the 10 essential or root teachings of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So it was Bhaktivinoda Thakur's vision passed on to his son, So a major, not at all a minor, a major part of Gaudiya Math, or Lord Bhakti Siddhanta's mission, was taking the message and giving it to the world. So there was a plan, and it was well written about in the Harmonists. It was his plan. It was his strategy. That he was having his another professor, Sanyal, who was an English professor at a, I think it's Bhadrak University, somewhere in Orissa. And the two, Rabindra's research uncovered, Professor Sanyal was the editor of Bhaktisiddhanta's writings, and Bhaktisiddhanta was the editor of his writings. They were like, you know, two peas in a pod. They were very closely connected. In the literary portion of Bhaktisiddhanta's mission. So Professor Sanyal was given the assignment of creating a book. The title of the book was Sri Krishna Chaitanya. And the book, when published, became about that thick, with very scholarly language, purposefully. And this was the book which the sannyas disciples of Bhaktisiddhanta were going to take to England to teach the people of England who is Sri Krishna Chaitanya. So even before his teachings, a very, very, very scholarly, lengthy background in the four sampradayas and so on and so on and so on. You know, for a Western audience that doesn't know anything, to understand the context in which Sri Krishna Chaitanya made his appearance. And then how he appeared in his pastimes and his teachings. And Rabindra's research showed that it took longer than expected. You know, scholarly work always takes longer than expected. And it was several years waiting. But the book was reviewed by Bhaktisiddhanta, because that's the relationship they had. Anything one wrote, the other would edit, and vice versa. That was the level of trust between the two. And in that Sri Krishna Chaitanya, Rabindra discovered this term, founder acharya, appears twice, where in the course of the text, Professor Sanyal is describing the disciplic succession, and the current link was Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, who he identified as the founder acharya, and enshrined within that language, as scholars will do when they make a term. It's cool, you make a term and then you explain the term. That's how you do it. And he explains the term. So it's more than an acharya. Prabhupada said he wanted, when he used the term founder acharya, it was following his spiritual master who used the term founder acharya. And I'll just share these two things. I mean, it's a wonderful work that Rabindra did. There's a book now called Founder Acharya. And for those of you that are not yet initiated, starting Janmashtami of 2015, it'll be required that you, before receiving initiation, you take a disciple course. And part of that disciple course is the subject matter of this Founder Acharya book. So that we, as a society, as we go forward into the future, in generations after Prabhupada's immediate disciples are gone, and even presently, to understand Prabhupada's unique position as the founder Acharya of ISKCON. Why is that important? Well, his special position is why it's important. And so that ISKCON, the institution that Prabhupada created, will carry on. Because what will hold ISKCON together going forward in time? Prabhupada. Many of us have thought about this. I've thought about it a lot. When Prabhupada was present, what brought the society together and held the society together? Prabhupada. Different things, but Prabhupada was there and unity was there because of our founder Acharya. And then Prabhupada left and there was some turmoil. But what held the society together through that period of time was the presence of Prabhupada's disciples who knew Prabhupada's mood and Prabhupada's intention, and so the society has, to whatever degree, we have maintained unity amongst the diversity. It's there because of the presence of Prabhupada's disciples. Going forward in time, what's going to hold the society together? Well, one essential ingredient, there are several, but one essential ingredient is a clear understanding of the unique position of Prabhupada as founder Acharya. Something akin, not identical, but very similar to the position of Ramanujacharya in Sri Vaishnavism. Now that's like a whole disciplic succession. This is a branch of a disciplic succession, but so it's not identical, but similar to the way that Prabhupada said it is, in the future there may be many acharyas, but there's one founder acharya. That means the acharyas are at the feet of the founder acharya. That's the unity. While there may be diversity, luminaries of great stature may come and they're at the feet of the founder acharya. And so it has many implications and deep significance for the preservation of the teachings and the preservation of the Sangha of Vaishnavas under those teachings. So if you are first initiated and you wish to then, after Janmashtami 2015, receive second initiation, Vedanta Chaitanya, you should specially note this, those persons before receiving second initiation recommendation will also have to take the disciple course. So we need people that are qualified to teach the course. And so that's what our GVC leadership is supposed to be doing between now and Janmashtami 2015, is making sure that there are qualified teachers to teach the course so that devotees can learn the course. And then going out over time, it has many, many nice things in it. I haven't taken the course, but I know those that have, and I know that are going to be teaching it, and they really like it. But part of it is this is Prabhupada's disappearance. What is his unique position? Not just, you know, especially for ISKCON, or the society in which those who are taking the message of the Bhaktivedanta books and living their lives according to the teachings of the Bhaktivedanta books, his position must be clearly understood. Founder Acharya. So, sometimes we say it in Sanskrit, Samstapaka Acharya. Samstha means to establish. He established teachings, of course the teachings coming from predecessor acharyas, but he expressed them in a particular mood and in a particular way. Comprehensively, exhaustively, systematically. And they're not inconsistent They're perfectly consistent with that of Bhaktisiddhanta and that of Bhaktivinoda Thakur and the previous acharyas going back in chronological time. But the application of them, for example, the formation of a GBC and the things that Prabhupada did, the procedures for initiation and the society which he wished to sustain and support those teachings and so forth. It's very important that those who wish to be true followers of Founder Acharya understand those things. And this verse, which I guess sometime later today we'll discuss, the verse is saying that great acharyas, these are prayers, chapter 2 of Canto 10 is the prayers of the demigods to Krishna in the womb of Devaki. And in that section, it's describing persons who are recognizing Krishna's position as they, by recognizing and absorbing themselves in the thought of Krishna and the message of Krishna and so forth, they achieve spiritual perfection before they leave this world, they leave behind a boat to cross the ocean of material existence, which is what Prabhupada did. As the founder Acharya, he left teachings and he left the society, the Sangha of Vaishnavas, whereby in the future persons who wish to cross the ocean of material existence could do so. And the section that I'd like to read from this morning is from Lilamrita, and it's the final days. That's what the chapter title is called. And right down to instructing his disciples how to die, how to live, and how to leave this body and enter into eternal life, Prabhupada was instructing as our founder Acharya. He was consciously doing that. So I'd just like to read the literature. It's very, in my opinion, empowered literature, writing, but Lilamrita is very, very special. So the final lesson is called, as a loving tension can sometimes exist between the Supreme Lord and his pure devotee, so now a similar tension existed between Srila Prabhupada and his followers. Prior to his disciples' desperate petition at his bedside, Srila Prabhupada had seen his duty as instructing his disciples how to die. Part of his mission was to set the perfect example in the most important lesson, how to pass life's ultimate test. But now, his disciples were asking him to postpone the lesson in dying and stay with them indefinitely in the preaching field. And Prabhupada had agreed. Previously, there is this appeal, fervent appeal. Prabhupada refused to eat. And devotees were saying, Prabhupada, if you don't eat, you won't be able to maintain your body. And if you don't maintain your body, you're gone and we won't have your association. Please. And Prabhupada was being indifferent, very aloof. What is the use of this body anyway? And all those detached statements. And the devotees started crying. And this was going on for days. Fervently appealing. He was like waving goodbye. Please don't leave us. And then there's a scene where he yawned and said, all right, I'll accept something to eat. And everyone went, yay. And so it was an assent or an agreement that he would stay. His body's emaciated. Who knows what pain he was experiencing. But for service to his disciples, he agreed. So that's this tension that's being spoken about. And Prabhupada agreed, showing that he had the ability to live if he chose. But sooner or later, he would have to return to the lesson on how a person should face the end of life. One special feature of Srila Prabhupada's activities is his relating intimately to the human condition while at the same time remaining aloof and transcendental. As a pure devotee, he was not subjected to the law of karma, which awards reactions for pious and sinful deeds. He was not born by the force of karma, nor would he die by force of karma. Give some scripture. But Srila Prabhupada, while always transcendental to this world, showed the conditioned souls how they too could come to the stage of liberation by constantly thinking about Krishna and serving him, so that at the time of death they could return to Krishna in the eternal spiritual world. As Prabhupada's lessons were always practical and universal, Srila Prabhupada's books, for example, were not merely theory, but were practical and full of realized knowledge. And Prabhupada practiced what he preached. His entire life was exemplary. He goes on describing how he was exemplary. As part of his intrinsic instruction and example, Srila Prabhupada knew he would have to show people just how to die. He had escaped death a number of times by Krishna's grace, by the prayers of his disciples, and by his own pure and powerful will to propagate his movement. But from the signs given to him by Lord Krishna in 1977, Srila Prabhupada began decisively and conclusively ending his mission in the material world. And among his final duties was his giving complete guidelines on how to die. He was perfectly showing how to do that which everyone has to do, but which is most difficult to do successfully. Die. But a loving conflict was there. He's showing the tension, the dialectic. Prabhupada loved his disciples. He also knew that they were not fully mature. His movement already had great potency and stature in the world, and yet it had many enemies also. He was inclined always to protect his devotees, his movement, and all living entities, even the animals. So when his most intimate and faithful disciples pleaded that they could not go on without him, he had turned from showing how to die, agreeing to stay with them and preach. But at what point they would be willing to let him go? At what point could he say that the world of Maya and the enemies of Krishna were all gone? At what point would his disciples become fully mature? In following his decision to stay, Srila Prabhupada turned himself over to his disciples, allowing them to care for him completely. Those who took part recalled that never before had Srila Prabhupada allowed such intimate dealings between himself and his disciples. The only thing comparable was New York in 1966, when he had been very intimate in dealing with the very first persons to join him, persons who had known nothing of the etiquette of approaching a spiritual master. But those who were present now, and who had also been present then, said that these days were even more intimate. Paragraph. At one point, Kirtananda firmly insisted that Srila Prabhupada drink a full cup of juice. And even when he said he had enough, Kirtananda felt awkward, insisting, "I am not like Mother Jasoda that I can do this," he said. "I keep remembering that you're my spiritual master." But Prabhupada allowed himself to be ordered by Kirtananda. Similarly, gives other names. Coaxed Prabhupada to follow certain diets and cared for his body constantly The other devotees were reminded of the story of Ishwara Puri, who gave intimate bodily service to his spiritual master, Madhavendra Puri, when Madhavendra Puri was in the last stages of his life and apparently invalid. According to Chaitanya Charitamrita, it was by this menial bodily service that Ishwara Puri proved his love for his spiritual master and was allowed to become the spiritual master of Lord Chaitanya. Srila Prabhupada deferred the lessons in dying in favor of giving his disciples an unparalleled opportunity to serve him in pure and simple love. And he allowed this not only for a few, but for whoever came to Vrindavan. Many came, and they were allowed to enter Srila Prabhupada's room, massage his body, and sit with him as long as they liked, day and night, chanting the holy name for his pleasure. Srila Prabhupada also recommenced his translating. Have you seen videos of that? Prabhupada's lying on his bed, no energy in his body at all, with the microphone before his mouth. And you read those purports and they're crystal clear, brilliant. I mean, he was detached from his body completely. And this was done openly, his Bhaktivedanta purports. Everyone's around the room and he's giving his Bhaktivedanta purports. Whereas previously he had always worked in solitude, he now encouraged all devotees to come as he lay in bed dictating his Bhaktivedanta purports. He was giving himself completely and declaring it also, telling the devotees present, "Never leave me. And I cannot live without your company." Imagine what those words meant for the devotees in the room. I was back in New York as the president of the New York Temple, wishing I was with Prabhupada, but serving him that way. They had asked him to stay, and he had agreed, consigning himself completely to their care. Those who were blessed to have this service felt themselves passing over all barriers of reluctance to serve, as well as all barriers of material desire. By intimately serving Srila Prabhupada, they felt the strength of complete surrender and sensed that this would sustain them always, even when Srila Prabhupada eventually did depart from the world. Prabhupada also continued speaking, as he did in recent months, about being unafraid of death and being fixed in transcendental knowledge. When receiving a presentation of some of his books recently printed in Portuguese, Prabhupada encouraged Hridayananda Goswami and said, "This is my life. The material world is just bones. The bones are not our real life. Our real concern is the living force. The bones may remain or go, it doesn't matter. The real life is sustaining the bones." There is even a history that there was a rishi who had only bones. So there is a science by which you can sustain life by only bones. Hiranyakashipu did it. "You are also doing it, Srila Prabhupada," Tamal Krishna said. "So, take care of the bones as long as possible," said Prabhupada, "but the real life is here. Always remember that. The material world means we are simply all protecting bones and flesh together. They have no knowledge of what they are." And when Atreya Rishi visited Prabhupada and said that he visited Tehran, Prabhupada said that he was ready to go. "But now you have to take a bundle of bones." These were, of course, the same themes that Prabhupada had always taught, the same themes within his books, but the lessons were more poignant and striking when Prabhupada applied them to his own situation. More than one devotee compared Prabhupada to Bhishma Dev, who gave important instructions in his last days. As Bhishma felt no pain and delivered learned and loving discourses even from his bed of arrows, and as Bhishma determined by his own will the time of his departure from the world, so Srila Prabhupada spent his last days oblivious to his physical condition, defying death, and instructing his spiritually innocent sons. Where Prabhupada's sons could no longer stand by and simply hear the philosophical lessons, Prabhupada had accepted their affection when they had cried for him to stay with them. And now they wanted to express that affection in the only world they understood, a world with Srila Prabhupada, living and talking with them, laughing or reprimanding them as he liked. They wanted him to eat and drink and become physically strong again. But again, Srila Prabhupada seemed to change. And he began refusing food and drink. He had postponed his passing away to exchange lovingly with his disciples, and yet, at the same time, by refusing to eat and drink, he was showing his preference for passing away. He admitted, when pressed, that it was an impossible course of action to live without food or drink. Nor did he expect or want miracles. If he was to get better, it would be by taking nourishment. But for reasons of his own, he would not eat. He said recovery was material and he didn't want it. He kept closely in tune with the will of Krishna, allowing the holy name to sustain him. The doctors who came were often puzzled. But those who were Vaishnavas understood and respected his prerogative. Prabhupada's servants made anxiety-filled attempts to induce Prabhupada to take regular treatment, but Prabhupada preferred to take only kirtan and bhagavatam, while at the same time sustaining a willingness to live. He empathized with his disciples' anxiety and patiently explained the puzzling situation they were in. He wanted their care, and he allowed them to try and treat him, knowing that it was bringing them more and more into a surrender of love. But gradually, it became more clear that Krishna's will was indicating Prabhupada's departure. Isn't this so nicely written? It's really amazing. Srila Prabhupada, Bhavananda coached, always working on the assumption that Prabhupada could stay if he wanted. Your presence on this planet is the only thing that's keeping the onslaught of Kali Yuga from really taking effect. You have no idea. We have no idea what will happen if you leave. It's not in my hands, Srila Prabhupada said, with perfect clarity of consciousness. Krishna Balaram. Srila Prabhupada always spoke clearly, logically, and with complete devotion to Krishna. Up until the last, he dealt with practical matters, forming a Bhaktivedanta Swami Charity Trust for reconstructing ancient temples in Bengal and arranging final details regarding ISKCON properties and monies. Through all dealings, he stayed always alert, and he absorbed himself in kirtan and bhagavatam. But it became obvious to his disciples that despite his promise, he was again moving inevitably towards giving the final lesson. He was teaching that love was beyond death, and a disciple's love could call the spiritual master back to the world to stay, and that a pure devotee has the ability to stay in the world beyond his allotted time. Meanwhile, however, he was progressing steadily to the final point. The devotees didn't feel angry with him or cheated, that he was doing so. He told them that he had free will given by Krishna. And they also, by their free will, had asked him to stay, and he had agreed. But they knew he was not obliged. If, despite their prayers, Lord Krishna was telling Srila Prabhupada that he should come back home to Godhead, what could they do but accept? If Srila Prabhupada was accepting, then they would accept also. Nothing, however, could change the fact of their surrendered love. It had now become a solid pact that could not be vanquished by any material changes. They had passed the test of eternal loving service, and that could not be taken away by death. Up until the end, there were interludes of sweetness, as well as displays of Prabhupada's indomitable mood of fighting for Krishna. One day, Prabhupada's sister, Pishima, arrived unexpectedly, and Prabhupada asked her to cook khichdi. At that time, Kirtananda was trying to put Prabhupada on the road to recovery by gradually increasing his liquids. And Kirtananda and the other devotees openly opposed the idea of his suddenly eating solid food, but Prabhupada insisted. It doesn't matter whether what she cooks does good to me or bad, said Prabhupada. She is a Vaishnavi, it will be good for me. And then he began speaking in an extremely humble way. Probably, I became a little puffed up because of my opulence and success. Now God has shattered that pride. If you don't have your body, what is there to be puffed up about? Bhakti Churuswami protested, Srila Prabhupada, whatever you have done for Krishna. Prabhupada's reply, that may be, but in this world, unknowingly you commit offenses. When Pishima heard this, she exclaimed, no, no, he never committed any offense. You cannot ever commit offense, said Bhakti Churuswami. You are God's very dear one. How can you commit offenses? I am a little temperamental, said Srila Prabhupada. I use the words like rascal and so on. I never compromised. They used to call it a club in one hand and a bhagavatam in the other. That is how I preach. Anyway, make arrangements for my sister. There were also visits from Srila Prabhupada's godbrothers. And again, Prabhupada asked forgiveness for his offenses. One time, Niskinchana Krishna Babaji, Puri Maharaj, Ashram Maharaj, Ananda Prabhu, Purushottam Brahmachari, and about 20 others came and sat next to Prabhupada's bed. He was resting when they arrived, and they joined the kirtan until he awoke. When he saw them, he asked to be raised up. Sitting in the center of his bed with his godbrothers all around, he addressed them, quote, all over the world, there is a beautiful field to preach Krishna consciousness, he said. I didn't care whether I would be successful or not. People are willing to take. And they are taking also, if we preach together, the saying of Mahaprabhu, Prithavite, will come true. We have everything. Spread the holy name and distribute prasadam. There's a beautiful field in Africa, in Russia, everywhere. They're accepting. When Prabhupada began asking his godbrothers to forgive him, they protested. You are the eternal leader, one of them asserted. You rule over us, guide us, and chastise us. Forgive all my offenses, Prabhupada repeated. I became proud of all my opulence. No, said Puri Maharaj. You never became proud. When you started preaching, opulence and success followed you. That was the blessing of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and Sri Krishna. There cannot be any question of your being offensive. when Srila Prabhupada presented himself as a Mahapatita, greatly fallen. Again, Puri Maharaj did not accept it. "You have saved millions of people around the world," he said. "Therefore, there's no question of offenses. But you should be called Mahapatita Pavana, the savior of the fallen." Prabhupada's disciples regarded Prabhupada asking for his godbrother's forgiveness as a manifestation of his humility. But they were also puzzled. Certainly Prabhupada's godbrothers were sincere in saying Prabhupada had committed no offense. Whatever he had done for Krishna. But Srila Prabhupada was also sincere in asking for forgiveness. That was the beautiful gem of his humility, to ask everyone forgiveness. For the purpose of preaching, displaying this gem was not always the most effective way to spread the merciful teachings of Lord Krishna in every town and village. But now it could be displayed in London. And now in Vrindavan, Prabhupada was showing his disciples how extra affection and gratitude, without the reprimands usually necessary in training disciples. This attitude of complete humility was a symptom of the highest stage of devotional life, Srila Prabhupada had explained in his books. Anyways, Srila Prabhupada had heard of the program of his disciple Lokanath Swami, who had taken a small group of men on a bullock cart. This is a very intense section. Listen carefully. Lokanath had told Srila Prabhupada how in the course of their travels they had recently visited tirthas such as Badrikashram and Bhim Kapoor. Srila Prabhupada was enlivened to hear this, and then he evolved a transcendental desire to go himself on a cart pulled by bullocks to circumambulate the arena of Vrindavan. Tamal Krishna and Bhavananda, who were serving Prabhupada with increased intimacy, felt themselves unable to support Srila Prabhupada in this desire, since they thought his fragile body could not survive such rough treatment on the roads. Then this tension, or two camps. Some said, "Prabhupada wants it." Some said, "It will kill him." And they fought. But Srila Prabhupada reasoned that dying on Parikrama is glorious. And he asked them to take him. A controversy developed among the devotees. Some said, Prabhupada's will to go on Parikrama should be immediately honored. As an order of the spiritual master, he wanted it and he should not be denied. The doctor, however, assured them that Srila Prabhupada's body would not survive the jostling of the cart. The many devotees who crowded around Srila Prabhupada's bed held different opinions, and Prabhupada could see this. Following his request, however, Lokanath went out and hired a cart with bullocks and prepared it for the ride. Lokanath and Hansaduda suggested that the Parikrama could go to the city of Vrindavan and visit the seven main temples of the Goswamis. But then they said, since the next day was Govardhan Puja, Prabhupada could go to Govardhan Hill. Tamal Krishna, Bhavananda, Bhakti Tru, however, protested adamantly against the Parikrama. "One day experiment," Prabhupada said, churning the controversy. "It's for one day. Best assured I will not die in one day." He liked the idea of going to Govardhan. "We shall make our cooking there," he said. Lokanath Swami, he assured them, was experienced. "Make a very good picnic," he said. After discussing back and forth, the devotees finally decided that early the next morning they would take Srila Prabhupada in a bullock cart to Govardhan. The majority of the devotees then left Srila Prabhupada alone for the night. Later that night, Srila Prabhupada received a visit from his Kinshana Krishna Babaji, who sat with Prabhupada chanting and sometimes speaking in Bengali. Suddenly, Tamal Krishna and Bhavananda came to Prabhupada's bedside. They were in tears and beside themselves with anxiety. Prabhupada understood, "You request me not to go?" "Well, Srila Prabhupada," said Tamal Krishna, "I'll tell you. I'm getting so upset sitting in the room upstairs. I was walking around. Two of the devotees told me the road is so bad that if you go on this road, you're going to be jostled back and forth. The road is terrible. I can't understand, Prabhupada, why it has to be tomorrow that we have to go. If somebody wants you to travel, I do, but why do you have to go in this condition? I can't understand it. Why are we throwing everything out the window that must be go tomorrow? I can't understand." "All right," Prabhupada said softly, immediately agreeing to the proposal that he not go. "Jai, Prabhupada!" Bhakti Truswami said. "Thank you, Srila Prabhupada," Bhavananda said. "All right, you're satisfied?" "Now I am, Srila Prabhupada," said Bhavananda. "Yes, I was in too much anxiety." "Never mind, I shall not put you in anxiety." Then Tamal Krishna said, "Actually, Srila Prabhupada, we're so much attached to you that you practically drive us to madness sometimes. Tonight we were becoming mad." "No, no, I shall not do that," Prabhupada said. "Babaji Maharaj," Prabhupada turned to his Kinshana Krishna, "Babaji, just see how much affection they have for me. Srila Prabhupada," said Tamal Krishna, "the way you deal with us simply deepens our attachment every moment." "It is my duty," said Prabhupada. And the devotees laughed warmly, understanding. Yes, they could understand that was his duty. By all his actions and dealings, Prabhupada's intention was to capture spirit souls and deliver them to Krishna. His method of loving service, his method was loving service, but he did not do it for himself. He was delivering them to Krishna. That was his duty. And then the last sentence here is, on November 14th, 1977, at 7:30 p.m. in his room at the Krishna Balaram Mandir in Vrindavan, Srila Prabhupada gave his final instruction by leaving this mortal world and going back to Godhead. So we're honoring his departure. His departure was exemplary because his whole life was exemplary. His departure marked the completion of a lifetime of pure devotion to Krishna. A few days before the end, Srila Prabhupada said he was instructing as far as he could, and his secretary had added, "You are the inspiration." "Yes," Srila Prabhupada replied, "that I shall do until the last breathing." Then it goes on with additional appreciations of how Prabhupada, in every act that he did, was instructive in service to Krishna, to bring souls closer to Krishna. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.